everyone. Welcome back to the Brewbound podcast. I'm Jess Infante, Brewbound reporter, still hanging out with my family at the Jersey Shore, counting alcohol ads on banner planes over the beach and surreptitiously checking out what all my friends and neighbors are drinking on their beach days from a safe social distance, of course. And my findings probably won't surprise anyone at all. If last year was the summer of seltzer, this is the summer of seltzer part two, back with a vengeance, summerier and seltzerier, or whatever terrible blockbuster movie sequel modifiers you can think of, which you probably can't think of because we can't go to the movies anymore. Anyway, hard seltzer is everywhere. It's been as high as 12% of total beer category dollar sales this summer. In the 52 weeks preceding June 13th, Americans have spent almost $2.7 billion on hard seltzer at tracked off-premise accounts, according to our friends at market research firm Nielsen. And for comparison, that's about the same as the GDP of the country of Bhutan, according to the United Nations. And seltzer's trends have only been accelerating. When you think about it, hard seltzer was pretty much made for this moment in time. It was born in the off-premise channel. It leaned heavily on social media marketing in its beginning. And now we've been buying beer to drink at home and can't put our damn phones down for the life of us. Maybe I'm projecting just a bit there. But right now, it's Friday, July 24th, the day after the Boston Beer Company's second quarter earnings call, which I'm going to write about right after this. But during the call, their CEO, Dave Berwick, summed up why seltzer has caught on pretty succinctly. It's rooted in health and wellness, with most offerings clocking in at 100 calories and low-carb and low-sugar counts. The myriad flavors are able to satisfy consumers' relentless need for variety, and most seltzers have the look and feel of a premium product. Their slim cans feel differentiated in your hand, and many of them have really sleek-looking packaging. Now, other stuff covered on that call was the fact that Boston Beer's net revenue for the first half of 2020 was $782.7 million. And a lot of it's coming from Truly Hard Seltzer and Twisted Tea. In fact, as of this recording, Boston Beer stock is trending at $780.50 a share, which is up almost 20% from just yesterday. Holy cow. And I don't always like to talk about my past life, mostly because I firmly believe that nobody cares. But I worked at Boston Beer for almost a decade, and I never bought stock through the employee discount program because I am pretty much a really big idiot. Right now, I'm pretty sure my biggest life regrets from choices that I actively made and made very wrongly are not buying stock when I could have and not studying abroad in college because I had sorority FOMO. And really, at this point, if I had bought enough stock, I could probably afford to take a semester abroad right now just for kicks. But anyway, back to seltzer. The hard seltzer landscape is dominated by two major players, Boston Beer's Truly and Mark Anthony Brand's White Claw, which is the clear market leader and is just such a dominant force in the industry. These two make up the vast majority of the share in the segment, with White Claw being even much bigger than Truly, but there are lots of other national and regional players. We gathered leaders from some of these brands for our Frontlines panel this week, plus Nielsen's own Danelle Cosmall to help us make sense of the numbers. It was a really great conversation, and we're about to play it for you right now. So go grab yourself a seltzer and have a listen. While you're doing that, here's a quick preview of next week's Brewbound Frontlines. Brewbound editor Justin Kendall and I will be chatting with the people behind one of the biggest stories in the craft beer industry last year. Brendan Waters and Chris Bradley, formerly of Just Kings and Convicts and now of Kings and Convicts and Ballast Point. We'll be chatting with those guys about their acquisition of Ballast Point from Constellation Brands and what it was like to have that deal close in March, just as the COVID-19 pandemic was shutting down bars and restaurants across the country. Brewbound Frontlines is live every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern on brewbound.com and Brewbound's YouTube and Facebook page. If you watch live, you can submit your questions via text and Justin and I will ask them for you. If you can't tune in at Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern, you can always hear it right here on the Brewbound podcast, wherever you like to listen to podcasts. And now here's our conversation with the leaders of Naughty Hard Seltzer and Country Hard Seltzer, Press Premium Alcohol Seltzer and Bubs Hard Seltzer, and Danelle from Nielsen.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Brewbound Frontlines, our weekly live stream check-in with beer industry leaders on the moves they're making in this ever-changing business climate amid the COVID-19 pandemic. My name is Justin Kendall. I am the editor of Brewbound. That is a noisy dog behind me named Dusty Rhodes. I do not know what his problem is. And joining me from the great state of New Jersey is Jess Infante. What is up, Jess?
Hey, Justin. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm throwing all kinds of curveballs that's doing these things live. So how's the pineapple wall this week?
Pineapple wall is great this week. Not going to lie to you, I really miss Dusty.
One of us does right now. This week, we are talking hard seltzers. Last year, hard seltzers were a $1.6 billion, with a B, dollar segment. Fast forward to this year, the segment continues to grow at triple-digit clips each week. I believe the July 4 holiday was the biggest ever hard seltzer week in off-premise retailers. So crack open your favorite hard seltzer. We're going to dive in here. Here to discuss today are Danielle Cosmall, VP of Beverage Alcohol Practice at Nielsen. Thank you for being here, Danielle.
Thanks, Dustin. Hi, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's great to see you. Archie Gleason, VP of Sales for Sycamore Brewing, the maker of Bubs Hard Seltzer, is here. What is up, Archie?
Justin, what's happening? Thanks for having me.
Glad you're here. Amy Wahlberg, co-founder of Press Premium Alcohol Seltzer, and that's Press with all caps. What's up, Amy?
Not much. Thanks for the invite and glad to be here.
And last but not least, joining us is Christian McMahon, the president of Wachusett Brewing Company, which makes the Naughty and Country Hard Seltzer lines. How you doing, Christian?
Cheers. That's my Jim Cook impression.
I do love a good product placement on here. Jess, what's happening next week?
So next week, really exciting. We are going to be joined by the leaders of Ballast Point Brewing Company. We will have CEO Brendan Waters and COO Chris Bradley. And we will talk all about how a little known Chicago craft brewery, Kings and Convicts, bought the San Diego craft brewery from Constellation Brands, what it was like taking over that business just 2 days before the COVID-19 pandemic shut down the entire on-premise. It was a huge story last year. So we will talk all about it next week.
Awesome. All right, let's get going here. Danielle, you're closer to the numbers than anyone I know. Last week, the hard seltzer segment accounted for 11% of beer category dollar sales in off-premise retailers. As I mentioned before, during the July 4 holiday week, hard seltzer sales reached their best week ever with $138 million in dollar sales and claimed nearly 12% of category dollars that week. So I'd like you to give us a bit of a top-level view of what you're seeing nearly 7 full months into 2020, and tell us how many billions of dollars this segment could be by the end of 2020.
Hey, Justin. When I was prepping and thinking about this, I was thinking it's been about almost eight months since Nielsen was on stage at Brewbound. And at the time, I mean, you mentioned the numbers already. At the time, we were saying, making a huge deal about how seltzers were closing out the year at $1.6 billion. At the time, it was $1.5 billion, but it closed out the year at $1.6 billion for 2019 in off-premise sales. And here we are, very different world and place for 2020. When we're talking about year-to-date sales for seltzers, seltzers are now at $2 billion in off-premise sales for year-to-date, growing still really strong triple-digit growth rates at about 255% for year-to-date. And then we're talking about annually, like if we do some type of comparison, 2019 seltzers had annual sales of, you know, $1.6 billion in off-premise. Annually right now for the latest 52 weeks, they're close, really, really close. It's over $2.9 billion, so really close to $3 billion. So crazy. And you mentioned the total size that they represent in terms of the category. So July 4th, there was a huge bump and really close to 12% of total category dollars, dropped back down last week to about 11%. But we really think that, you know, for the most part, especially during the beginning weeks of COVID, we started to see jumps in share of about like 0.2 to 0.3, you know, share points each week. And that slowed a little bit. And then I think we saw a bit of a bump around July 4th. And because we're in the midst of, you know, the core summer weeks, I think we're going to see that pick up again.
Do you anticipate that the share is going to stay in that 11 to 12% range, or how high could we potentially see that go this year?
I mean, by the end of the summer, I think there could be points that we see it, you know, reach 13%, maybe a little bit higher as we go into the winter months as well. I think what's interesting is if we take last year as an example, seltzers finished out the summer at about 5.5%, I think, and then kind of dipped down to 5. So we've talked so much, especially in 2019, how seltzers, there's so much seasonality to it, and that, you know, 2019 summer was the summer of seltzers. But from what we saw, especially during the first couple of weeks of COVID, seltzers can break past that seasonality. You know, there's a lot in terms of what could come this fall too.
Interesting. So Danelle, this is a segment that's really been a two-horse race with White Claw and Truly remaining the dominant brands. Now, I don't want to crush the hopes and dreams of our panelists, but how much hope is there for regional or even national players to get a piece of the pie?
So first, if you look at, to your point, yeah, you know, two brands are accounting for about 3/4 of hard seltzer dollars right now. I took a step back within just the past couple of weeks, and I started looking at if we were to start to define craft seltzers or regional seltzers in some way. And, you know, similar to when we talk about craft beer, people often ask us how we define craft beer. And there isn't a specific Nielsen definition of craft beer. We can define it in any way, especially in ways that our clients want or what might be relevant for that situation. And I think we'll probably end up doing the same thing with seltzers for now, and just kind of putting some high level definitions of big players versus regional players. I looked across all suppliers for seltzers and I took out the 7 big suppliers. So some of those suppliers have multiple brands, but if you take out those 7 big suppliers, that group of big brands accounts for 98% of seltzer dollars, leaving the rest of those, you know, smaller brands, which is about 76 brands, or account for just 2% of seltzer dollars.
So let's get the rest of our panel involved here. Amy, press is attempting to be one of those national players. When you're looking at the path ahead, what is your strategy for growing into one of the top players? And why are you confident that the door is still open?
You know, we really want to be able to give the consumer a choice. Like you said, it's been up to this point, 2 primarily large brands. I call it the David and Goliath, right? And, you know, I think there's a lot of room on the shelf for absolutely some other players. You know, there's a lot of different demographics out there that seek different things in beverages, you know, whether it's flavor first or APV or, you know, any other critical attribute that they're looking for to satisfy their thirst, if you will. So honestly, I think there's a lot of room again for, you know, again, just being able to satisfy the different needs for the different consumer groups out there. There's definitely more than 2 groups. So I think that's going to shake it up a little bit. I think now that the awareness is out there and, you know, there's different segments within this category. I believe, Danielle, you just said that seltzer is now a category of its own, which is great. But also within that, a lot of the consumer doesn't quite understand that there's, you know, wine-based, spirit-based, or a malt-based seltzer. And so I think the more people are starting to learn and know, you know, you're going to see that mix-up happen sooner than later.
Definitely. So Christian, Wachusett appears to be playing a portfolio strategy with its hard seltzer brands, having both Naughty and Country Hard Lemonade seltzer. So what are the advantages do you think of taking a portfolio strategy? And have you found that the Naughty drinker isn't the same as the Country Hard drinker?
Yeah. So I think, you know, kind of building on what Amy said for us, we look at, and not to, can't contradict Danielle's numbers, but in more of an independent market, we're seeing that we think it can be a 10 share of the category, the local seltzers. And maybe that's easier in an independent market where you're not dealing with obviously chains and limited SKUs and authorizations where we can compete. And we kind of look at our current footprint and said, all right, well, it's about a 5 to 7 million seltzer market right now in our distribution footprint. And so you say, all right, there's 500 to 700,000 cases available for local brands. And that's been us obviously for 5 years now, 2016, when we launched. You have Arctic Summer / Harpoon now in New England, and Night Shift has got into it. So you have these local brands all fighting for that, what we believe can be 10% if it's well executed. And then within that, to your point, Jess, is like, okay, well, you just can't be a one-trick pony. The world probably doesn't need another 5% 100 calorie entry, right? It's covered with them. So I think we got to kind of hustle and be on the fringes. And that's, you know, for us, Country was, that's where that really came from. We've been making lemonade seltzer since 2017. And I think one of the biggest surprises through the seltzer growth is the lack of hit it has had on the lemonade category, or the traditional RTD categories like Mike's Hard Lemonade, Smirnoff Ice. They're all still doing great. The volume hasn't come at their expense. So it shows you people still like those flavor profiles. So when we've been experimenting with the lemonade flavors, we found it was hitting a different audience that was looking maybe a little bit more of a sweeter tooth. maybe wasn't looking for some of the health benefits. And again, we've done some higher ABV versions, some single serve can versions. I think, you know, the local brands kind of got to hustle and be on the fringe a bit to grab some more of that category.
Totally makes sense. So Archie, Bubs is the newest entrant here. What's the strategy that you guys are taking to market?
Our strategy to market has been, you know, it was kind of came at a little delay as we looked to launch, and then COVID happened, and then the sets got scuttled for a while. So we had product looking for a home for a minute and managed to get it out there displayed warm. But our strategy has been to differentiate ourselves kind of with a locale play. And, you know, it was a lot of back and forth with our brewer. Our brewer had a past life at Sam Adams in Cincinnati making Truly. And so to have that kind of acumen on the team, and Brad Bergman, who was able to kind of do a lot of back and forth with test batches and find the right mix of ABV and calorie count, we ended up landing at 4 ABV and 77 calories. So it's been pretty differentiated in that way. It's kind of the low end there and has been really well received.
We've seen hard seltzers transform in the short time that they've really been out there from a niche product aimed at people interested in health and wellness to a behemoth that transcends gender and geography. How has each of your marketing strategies changed as this category has evolved? And I'll start with Amy.
So it is interesting to look at the different demographics and the different market share that we're pulling from. As Christian said, you know, it's not just the FMB category. It's a little bit from, you know, wine and spirits and consumers that didn't like alcohol or didn't like the taste of alcohol, excuse me. Not that they didn't want to drink alcohol. They didn't like the taste of it. And I think this is this category, it fits, you know, as you said, a broad spectrum, you know, in the niche marketing and the different nuances between each of the brands. Seltzer is all we do. We're not a beer brand that switched over. We were derived out of my passion for seltzer and for a premium product that didn't exist in this category at that time. And so I think, you know, it's about, again, just honing in on what you started with and continuing to do that the best you can. And that's what, you know, we're doing and with our market. And again, just being able to deliver that premium product that, you know, wasn't earlier available.
We've got a lot of questions coming in from the audience out there. We apparently have struck a nerve here that we haven't in recent weeks. Christian, on the strategy, you guys have been doing Naughty. You're doing Country Hard Seltzer now. How has your strategy evolved in this short amount of time?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because I think in the first couple of years, it was about education. You know, what is this? Spiked Seltzer had laid the path a bit for a few years before us, but after, you know, and until that time, there was no one really trying to explain what this was. And I think, you know, now, you know, at least in the Northeast, we don't have to do that as much. Seltzer, non-alcoholic seltzer is very developed here. So the concept of hard seltzer is easier to accept. So I think now it's less about what it is versus who you are within that. And again, with two dominant players kind of leading the way by as becoming like the default purchase, now it's almost disrupting that purchase. How are you going to stop them from buying the two leading brands to actually focus on your brand? Because they're going in almost pre-sold to buy one or the other. And that's, I think we've gone from education to disruption a lot over these 5 years.
Christian, what role does seltzer play in Wachusett's tap room? Do you have it available for people who come in?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's hugely important because I think it turns us from being just a destination tap room, you know, with everyone coming in with their phone and rating our beers on tap to more of a good time drinking establishment because we have something for everyone. We make cider, we make seltzer. We have 8 IPAs. We have obviously a fruit beer portfolio led by Blueberry. So I think for us, seltzer's really made us a very well-rounded venue that anyone can come to and enjoy our products, just versus the craft beer seekers. So I think it plays an absolutely crucial role in the success of our tap rooms.
But Archie, how about does Sycamore offer Bubs in the tap room as well? I know times are weird and you've only launched it just as the pandemic was starting, but how do these brands interact in the on-premise channel?
We sure do, and we sell a lot of it in the tap room. It's our tap room's more beer garden than tap room. Tap room hasn't reopened since the pandemic, but the beer garden is on an acre of land, so there's a lot of folks there. And at the end of busy nights before Bubs, when our team would be cleaning up, they'd literally find like 12 packs of White Claw cans that people had snuck onto the property. And so it's nice to be able to offer them something right there that fills the need that they're looking for. And it's a product that's ours, that's local, that's really tasty.
Great. Now, Amy, without obviously Press stands on its own and doesn't have a parent beer brand, you guys have always been independent like that. So do you have anything to offer drinkers some kind of like place to come visit? Is there any way to create that experience? I know everyone's doing it digitally right now, so maybe it's something you've been trying.
No, you know, we don't have a large on-premise that we don't have a on draft or anything like that. Pretty much we our focus has been off-site and through retail and chain. And now with COVID, obviously a lot of consumers are going for more of the quick grab and go, which has helped because we started more in an independent setting as an independent brand. You know, there was more opportunity there for us. Now that we are in the chains and starting to get more of that recognition, it's changing. But no, other than that, we are sold. We're doing a lot more e-commerce. We're starting to work more with, you know, the Drizzly and the e-commerce online and the delivery services, local and national. That's changing the landscape quite a bit right now. And so we're really focusing on that.
We've got a lot of hard seltzer questions coming in. And Danelle, we have one for you and Nielsen. Has Nielsen determined the source of volume for hard seltzer's explosive growth? What percentage is coming from the beer category? What percentage is incremental to the beer category?
I mean, Justin, this is something else that we talked about in December of where the volume is coming from. And, you know, I've always said that I think people want us to separate that into it's an exact percent that's coming from each one of those categories. And I think it was an unsatisfying answer that in a lot of times I said, it's because there were new buyers coming in. Obviously, it's a new segment. And a lot of those purchases were incremental purchases to alcohol. So it wasn't that people were swapping out at the time when we were talking about 2019. It wasn't that people were swapping out other types of alcohol for seltzer. They were making that additional purchase or else they were new buyers. And, you know, and once COVID hit and we saw another big spike in sales for seltzers, we took another look to see if that's still happening, just because I think it was hard to imagine that those incremental purchases were happening, especially when people were doing their pantry loading. And that's when we just started to see the shift. So when you look at hard seltzer buyers and how they were spending across beer, wine, and spirits during the months of March for 2020 versus how they were spending for beer, wine, and spirits in 2019, we saw that they decreased their spending in both wine and beer. And they decreased it. It's been a couple months since I've looked at this, but they decreased it by about either 4% or 5% for each of the beer and wine categories. However, they increased their spending with spirits.
Christian, for Wachusett, have you seen any cannibalization or erosion of the beer volume or beer sales in favor of seltzer? Or how much of that's incremental?
Yeah, for us, it's interesting, right? Because we're a 25-year-old regional craft brewery that all of a sudden had to convert itself to a seltzer factory. And it's like, how do we do that without damaging our core beer equity? And especially when our highest volume brand is a fruit beer, blueberry. Which if you're saying what, if there's going to be any impact, it'd probably be into that line. There's actually been zero, which is, you know, for us, we're pretty happy about. And, you know, the beer brands have obviously continued to grow over these last 3 or 4 years since we've launched seltzer. So we haven't seen any internal cannibalization within our own set. And again, it's just been an interesting evolution of, you know, we've been in this location brewing beer for 25 years. And, you know, as we've talked recently, everything changes. How do we get slim cans on our line? How do we make variety packs? And you just convert yourself into and ask that question, are we doing all the right things for the overall business? But the nice part is there's been no direct impact from the seltzer into the beer portfolio.
Archie, in the short time that Bubs has been out, have you seen an impact on Sycamore's beer sales?
No, in fact, we haven't. And it's funny, I rewatched Danelle and you speaking a few months ago, kind of right at the beginning of COVID and the lockdown and everything. And Danelle was talking about how she shopped and where she shopped and so on. And one of the points of that interview, she hit on how there are brands that people have come to trust and rely on and kind of lean on in a bigger way during this. And one of the things that we were really excited as COVID started, we found ourselves as one of those brands that had a more accelerated growth rate than some other brands. as things started to happen for us at retail and we were able to get Bubs out there, I think that trust kind of, we were able to borrow some trust from the Sycamore line onto the Bubs line as they got kind of displayed side by side and so on. So I haven't seen any loss from the beer line. I think the consumers are viewing it as just a different segment altogether for us too.
Interesting. I mean, that kind of dovetails a little bit with a question both that Justin and I had on our list and one that we've gotten from the audience. So audience panel portion of the question is, I'm wondering if any of the panelists see any regulatory or legal changes coming to make it easier to introduce lower ABV drinks using different alcohol bases. So as the High Noon, as an example, is treated the same way as a White Claw or a Press. So for everybody watching at home, if you're not familiar, High Noon is a vodka base, whereas other seltzers maybe aren't. So Danelle, I know we talked about this yesterday, but we do see entrants from spirits producers and wine producers. One, do you think consumers view those as any different than they do the seltzers that come from beer producers? And do you think that any of this kind of matters at retail?
So without having done specific research, consumer research on this, my gut is to say no, consumers don't know the difference. It's shelved in a really similar place. It's a lot of times very similar drinking occasions. And so I think consumers aren't really differentiating. There is a difference in price. And so that's one of the biggest differentiators and ways that consumers would see the differences. You know, when we're talking about those spirit-based seltzers and the wine-based seltzers, they are much smaller. It's less than $200 million annually right now. So when we compare that to what we have with kind of the traditional seltzers, it's of course a much smaller category, but I think there's huge potential for growth for them. And I think we're going to continue to see a lot of interaction here. It's actually something we're putting together a new seltzer study right now, and it's on our list to understand what that interaction is of kind of that core traditional seltzer drinker and how they're purchasing the wine and spirit seltzers along with ready to drink cocktails. Cause I think that falls within that space too.
Fantastic. I'm really interested to read that when it's available. For everybody watching at home, if you have a question you want us to ask these guys, text it to 617-336-8560. Great audience question from the group. Do any of the panelists think they are growing by attracting new category users, or are you getting pulling drinkers from your competition, mostly Truly and White Claw? And if so, what are the keys to attracting those users? Amy, where do you think the typical press drinker is coming from? Are they new to the seltzer category? Are you pulling them off some of the larger brands?
Both. You know, I think there's a big discovery period right now. Again, I think that originally they were only given a couple of options. And now that, you know, consumers realize that there's a lot of other seltzers out there, they're exploring and they're looking to the left and the right now to see what might fit them better. So I believe there's some of that. Also with some of the out of stock issues that some of the others have had, I think that helps kind of funnel some of that over a little bit for some new trial experience. And then where else? I think it is for us, a lot of it's word of mouth. It really is. Our fan base is huge. It depends on the age group, I think. You know, there's a lot of discovery, not on the Instagram, you know, Facebook segment that is a little bit more old school, that's finding out in different ways. But I'd say they're new category users as well.
Christian, where do you think naughty and country hard seltzer drinkers are coming from?
Well, for the category, obviously, once you hit 2 billion, you're pulling from everywhere at that point. And I think early on, like, we definitely started from hard soda, you know, really seltzers really helped kind of accelerate the decline of that category. Ciders got hit early. Now you see domestic light beers being impacted by it. Even obviously some of the Mexican beer brands. I think for us, you know, what is it? It's sessionable. It's flavorful. It's better for you. You know, whether that impacts rosé wine or Tito's and sodas, or, I mean, it's just hitting a lot of those different occasions now that were dominated by other brands in the past. And again, once you're at that scale, you know, you're not just saying I'm taking it from one or the other, you're getting it from a lot of different places. And I think that's probably, again, in the last 5 years, we've seen that more and more.
Great. Archie, do you guys have any thought, any early read on where Bubs's drinker base is coming from?
Yeah, I tend to agree with both Amy and Christian that it's kind of pulling from a lot of different places all at once. Having been in beer for a long time, in a post-Carrie Bradshaw world, we've always tried to figure how to get people back from spirits into malt beverage. And this has been a great way to do that, offering, you know, fresh fruit flavors and a drink that's really refreshing and not necessarily, like Christian said, better for you, not weighing people down as much as the IPAs that I like to drink.
When we see the products out there and sort of the the same sort of 4 to 5% ABV, 100 calorie, you know, the table stakes that have become the industry standard here. Where do you look for white space? Where do you look for the opportunities that are out there? And I guess I'll start with Christian, because you had a play last year with Naughty Extra. And so I'd like to hear your experience on that.
Yeah. So you look at, you know, once it got established, like where we can find different things. So a couple of years ago, we were the first one to launch a rosé version, right? Trying to take the rosé trend and the seltzer trend, bring it together. Then obviously, you know, seeing the success over years of the large format, higher ABV brands like Four Loko, like, okay, let's look at that. And that was Extra Naughty, 8%, 19.2-ounce can. Let's see if we can bring those two worlds together. And again, find some opportunities on the fringe. You know, this year it was bringing the lemonade together and going out. You know, we thought we were going to be the first one out. Someone beat us to market quite handily. But, you know, now taking lemonade and seltzer, blending those two together. And I think, again, for the fighters, you know, us smaller fighters, we're just going to have to be nimble. We're going to have to be creative and innovative. And if it works, we're going to know that other people are going to follow us and copy it and amplify it. But it might give us a 1 or 2 year head start on some different trends. So I think if we're going to try to grab that 8-10% local share, we're going to have to think out of the box and be different if we're going to compete.
Amy, how do you view differentiation of product? Like, what are the spaces and places that you're looking to play that maybe others aren't?
Well, again, I'd bring up, you know, our premiumization. I think there in every category, whether it's beer, wine, spirits, there's a good, better, best. And that, you know, I think the way that brands are marketed, the ingredients they're using, the way they're positioning themselves all plays into that a little bit as well. We're a very consumer first focused brand, meaning that, you know, we'll fight for the consumer on what I think is they're looking for as opposed to what they're given at this point. And by that, I mean, there's a lot of variety packs out there. And that's because a lot of the retail outlets had space for, you know, one package or, you know, were very limited at first. And so we were kind of, I don't want to say forced, but I believe that it was the easiest path to be able to get product on shelves and many varieties. Ultimately, I think that's going to change to more of a, and we're doing this specifically as well right now, is creating more single flavor 12 packs. And again, I think that's what the consumers are starting to look for. You know, once now that the discovery period's over a little bit of that brand's flavor, they know what they like and they just want more of that one now. And so I think it's a matter of, again, listening to the consumers, you know, flavor first, coming up with the new exciting profiles that they may have not seen before. That's not typical. And, you know, again, connecting with them, giving back and being a brand that they want to be a part of.
I think we're changing the name of this to Seltzer Bound at this point, seeing how many questions are coming in and how many people are watching this. Archie, where are you guys looking for white space with Bubs? I mean, I know you're fresh and you're new, but where do you go?
Yeah, I kind of alluded to it earlier, Justin, in a lower cal version than the consumer can find on shelf currently in our marketplace. And, you know, with that, you've got it just by virtue of the fact that it's lower in cal, it's lighter. It's even lighter than some of the others on shelf there that may have a little more to them. That's kind of where we're really leaning and trying to leverage that differentiation point is lower calorie. You know, initially it was just, you know, 77 calories was what we were leaning on. And as the message has evolved now, it's kind of our tagline, 77 calories of good times. So, that's where we are. One thing that's been kind of interesting and kind of going back to one of the last questions was during COVID when we're still shut down at the tap room, we popped up a delivery mechanism where we repurposed all of our bartenders and had a delivery apparatus for about a month that did a lot of business. And as I said, we were trying to find space on shelf before the sets took place for Bubs. Out of nowhere, Bubs became kind of the second biggest seller behind our IPA on the delivery side of things. And that was really an eye-opener for us of folks really wanting to kind of get into that, and pretty happy that we had that opportunity to get it in front of people.
There are plenty of eye-openers in this space. Danelle, speaking of those, and I guess where the white space is and the opportunities, what have you guys seen as far as, you know, breaking that norm? And I guess to that end, you know, we talk a little bit about lemonade and the growth there. And you can see in the numbers that it's been an important part of the success of Boston Beer and Truly so far this year. So could you extrapolate a little more on the opportunity there?
On the opportunity specifically with lemonade or just flavors?
Absolutely. Lemonade and flavors.
Yeah. Amy, I mean, I'll kind of first touch on the variety pack piece of it because I think that's part of the story. And Amy spoke a little bit to variety packs. And last year, throughout the entire year, I kept looking and consistently variety packs accounted for 66% of seltzer dollars. I just looked this week and seltzers account for 67% of seltzer or variety packs account for 67% of seltzer dollars. So it just goes back to, it is something that's important to consumers. It's a way that they're entering. As part of that consumer study that we're doing that I mentioned, I had some like sneak peek looks this morning at some of it. And we looked brand by brand of like that role of variety pack versus the flavor pack. And for what I only had a chance to look at one brand, but within that one brand in particular, variety packs, of course, kind of what you would expect. They're bringing in trial. So they're doing their job with trial. But then when you look on who's repeating, it's one specific flavor that's bringing back the repeat buyers. So that's the important role of those one particular flavor. And I love that Amy said that they're thinking about doing the 12 packs for like by flavors, because we've also had that question of, are consumers purchasing 12 packs just because it's easier than purchasing 2 6 packs or whatever? And so I think we'll start to see a shift as we start to see more and more 12 packs of individual flavors. And then when we start looking at things like lemonade, I mean, you guys reported on this, that in the latest week, you know, Truly Lemonade Mix was the second fastest growing in terms of growth contributor. It was like the second fastest growth contributor to the entire beer FMB seltzer category last week. So definitely making a splash.
Really interesting audience question that just came through. How critical is chain grocery in order to gain success for local and regional seltzer brands? And so Archie, how important has grocery chain been for you guys to get Bubs out to market?
It's been a very big deal. This is a chain driven area of the world in the Southeast here. And so being able to get on shelf with that kind of right out of the jump has been something that's been a really big deal. And as everyone's trying to enter the segment, we were fortunate enough to have a couple big retailers pick us, pick me to be the one that local that they took a chance with. And it's worked out well for us and for them. One thing, you know, to add on Danelle and Amy's commentary as well, with Variety Pack, we, you know, trying to forecast what you don't know yet, where we're going to end up. And we did one Variety Pack and then we picked one of the three flavors to feature in a 12 pack as well. And going in, you know, my assumption was that it would be probably 5-1 Variety Pack sales versus the single flavor, the pink lemonade. And it actually has only been 2-1. So on one hand, maybe we guessed right with the flavor that we'd go with in the 12 pack. But to your point, it seems to be something that folks have got the variety pack for sampling and then come back for the flavor that they really liked.
Really interesting. I mean, I know that's at least what I do personally. So it makes sense.
Yep.
Christian, I know New England states vary by whether or not they're chain or not, but how important has chain placement been for you guys?
Yeah, so less important for us. I mean, our three lead states are low indexing grocery and C-store. So it's hand-to-hand combat, which is for this category for a local brand is exactly what you want. So definitely, you know, when Naughty launched in 2016, we were probably had a footprint of, you know, almost half the country, and we were the second player going in. So we were getting a lot of the grocery interest in chain. And obviously once the national brands came out, those opportunities were going away. So we've really retrenched to our core market and our core footprint, and that's fine. And also to build on that last question, interesting data from us is, you know, over the last few years, we've had 3 tap rooms, brew yards, and in the surrounding kind of 15-20 mile radius of those, we actually sell more individual flavor SKUs than the variety packs, because they go to our tap room brew yard, they know what they like, they drink it, and that's all they want to buy. And every other market that's not surrounding goes to that 2/3, 1/3. So it just goes to show the power of sampling and, you know, kind of intense sampling, we'll call it. but it really accelerates that kind of core flavor or core preference that they like much more than when you're just in the mix everywhere else. And it's the other piece, which, you know, for Amy, Archie, and us, is shelf space. How many SKUs are you actually going to get on the shelf now? You know, especially with a lot of the majors, you know, tying up, trying to grab as much of the space as possible. So sometimes we're just limited to the variety pack, unfortunately, as well, even though consumers are demanding that one or two flavors that they really like. It's harder for the mid-majors or and smaller guys to get those extra ones on the shelf.
Amy, I know press is just about nationwide, but can you share with the audience what states you're strongest in and how important was it for you to secure those chain placements to get there? Let's just set the scene a little bit for everybody who's watching.
Yeah, we just had a milestone actually yesterday that we are in 48 states now. So we're really excited about that. You know, it's no small feat as an independent brand for sure. Retail chain placement is very critical. As the others have said, this is that space, right? It is definitely that consumer as well. But not only that, it's about exposure. You know, when they're seeing palettes of some of the other brands, it's just about getting that word out there. We also do a lot of samplings in stores, or we did last year, which for us has been a great marketing tool for us. Again, being able to sample the liquid, educate them, you know, in a no-cost way to be able to sample and try something different that they may not have before. So we're in 48 states and, you know, some of them we just rolled out, but Midwest is doing really well for us, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Illinois. But we started there and we're also based there. I'm from Minnesota originally. I live in Wisconsin now. And so I don't know, it's either my friends drink a lot, possibly, or we've just spent a little more concentration there as well. And, you know, again, it's a matter of survival a bit for independent brands rolling out in a certain way. Midwest was easiest for us originally. Then we moved down south because of the weather and so forth. East Coast was easier because they were more open to seltzers. Non-alcoholic seltzers were big there first, hence the spike and so forth on the East Coast. And so they were more adaptable. And then we just moved out west. We just got into California. Texas has been great for us. We've been there just a short amount of time, but really well received there. And so, you know, it's a little of everywhere. And again, depends kind of on the, in our distributors and the retailers and everything, you know, all that plays a little bit of a factor into it. But we're excited to see what the next year is going to bring for us. Absolutely.
Awesome. Danelle, I know it's hard for us to be able to say like how much shelf space seltzer gets relative to other things, but can you maybe explain for the audience dollar sales wise how seltzer stacks up against craft beer?
Yeah, I mean, when we talked about how seltzers are within that 11 to 12% of total category dollar range, that's exactly what Nielsen tracks for craft beer. And that's that broader definition of craft beer. So not just about, you know, independent or the BA defined craft beer, it's that broader definition of craft beer. And within Nielsen measured channels, craft represents about 12% of the category. So seltzers is right within that range.
Great. Another audience question. Has there been a breakdown in who buys seltzer? Is it men, women, or evenly split? And I know you guys have done a lot of data on this, and I think I know what the answer is, but why don't you tell the audience?
It's pretty evenly split. That's what makes seltzer so incredibly unique to so many other different types of alcohol segments.
We may have a myth bust here with one of these audience questions. Christian, for those out there who also make beer, what is your gross profit like on seltzer versus beer? I have heard that seltzer is very cheap to make. Is this, you going to bust some myths?
Myth. You know, obviously it all depends, like beer, what you put in it, quality of your flavor houses, et cetera, you know, concentration of flavor. But, you know, there's a lot of factors, right? How fast does your line run? Are you running at half speed versus full speed? You know, obviously the cost to make base, you know, originally, when we first launched, we made a malt base, then we actually were purchasing base. Now we make our own proprietary base. It's not cheap. So that is very much largely a myth. It is right in line with our beer portfolio. Never mind variety packs. You know, that means it's going on your line twice. So even though you ran it once, you made all those loose cases of four different flavors, put them in your warehouse on a fork truck. That fork truck's got to bring them all back. All the guys got to get back on the line. You got to make it again. So when it's all said and done and 2/3 of your business are going through those variety packs, that is not a great model, especially for smaller or regional guys that might not have automated systems. So I'm going to go 100% myth.
Archie, is that your experience at Sycamore so far?
That it is, Justin. It is. I'll also be in the myth camp. You know, all the way down, almost every point Christian mentioned, it comes down to what you're putting in the can itself. And, you know, when you're putting real fruit in a can, that's expensive. And then on top of that, when it comes to variety pack, we don't have a variety packer. We have a really hardworking team of guys that are variety packers. And you know, there's the switchover of the line itself from our 16-ounce cans that we use for beer to the 12-ounce sleeks for the seltzer. And then packing it all on pallets, having it stacked. And then these guys, and, you know, on our internal Slack channel to keep up with inventory, especially during COVID, they'll put, okay, this many mountain candy, this many kegs of this, whatever. And then it'll get entered into inventory. And when they put variety packs of Bubs on there, they always put at the very end, packed by hand, just to drive their point home of the hard work they're doing, and can't be more grateful for the work they're doing to make what we do possible.
So we've seen a lot of talk about slim can shortages. For those of you who package in the slim can format, are you guys running into any issues? I'll start with Amy.
No, it's a concern for sure. But if you plan ahead and, you know, again, you know, anticipate the trend and do all you can up front. We're trying to mitigate that as best we can. We've so far have done a really good job of that. Sure, it's a concern, absolutely. Just logistics and supply chain in general because of the environment right now. You know, they're not running free, let me tell you that. But, you know, without a little bit of a hiccup, it's been okay.
Archie, have you seen any of these logistical hiccups?
So far, so good. You know, one of the things that has been unique about this is the commitment we had to make in terms of the quantity of cans that we would take on and receive all at once, you know, to do three flavors. Our order right now that's in process is for 1 million cans, you know, 330,000 of each one that we'll have stacked waiting to be filled with some effervescent love.
Well, if ever you have overage, we can help you out with that. So
thanks, Amy. No worries.
Christian, are you experiencing any issues there on the supply chain side?
Yeah, no, we're okay there as well. We actually almost opposite. It's been really good with our supplier. Country since day one has exceeded our expectations. We're already at triple what our original forecast for the year was at, and we just launched end of April. So we've had to go back to them like, we need them more, we need them faster, and they're actually working well with us. So it's been our number one SKU overall for the company the last 3 months, and we've been able to react to that. But literally, it's been watching daily rate of sale, getting information from the wholesalers in real time, and having to react so fast because this market is just, it's crazy what can go up, what can go down. There's been a lot of volatility, obviously, with some of the brands in the space. You know, the tide's not rising for all the boats, so you got to be able to react to which brands are moving and which ones aren't. And we've been unfortunate with Country that our supplier has been able to keep us in the flow, which was well beyond what we originally had forecasted, which is great.
Danelle, how have line extensions performed versus pure plays? Given that Bud Light Seltzer had a somewhat of a lukewarm reception, should future entrants consider only launching with brand new brands? Do you think Coors Seltzer stands a chance at stealing share when it launches in the fall? I know we've seen a mix, but the two national players are standalone seltzer brands.
I mean, I think it depends. I think there's something to say for launching a brand off of an existing brand that has, you know, a following. I think because seltzer is such a unique segment, I think that it also makes sense to launch a unique brand. I think it just depends on what the goals are for each of those brands and the suppliers.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. And then Molson Coors launched Vizzy, which has antioxidants from the acerola cherries. We got an audience question asking, how important do you think enhanced versions are with antioxidants and vitamins? Is that anything that Nielsen's been able to get its arms around?
We haven't looked at that. I mean, we've looked at that in non-alc segments, and we looked at that a couple of years ago. That isn't something that we've looked at recently, but definitely I'll put it on my list.
Definitely something to watch on the horizon. So one more audience question. I think we can throw it to the whole panel. As beverage flavors continue to converge, how are hard seltzers going to get ready for more competition from hard tea, lemonade, cider, fruit, coffee, kombucha, et cetera, et cetera? Is this something that you guys have on the horizon that you're watching out for? Christian, what do you guys look at competitively?
I mean, it's already here. I mean, I feel like we're in that already. And I do think the category is going to react to innovations every year, probably more volatile than most. So, you know, there's already conversations about what next year's big idea is going to be. And we're thinking about that too. And again, because we have to have that fighter mentality. So I do think you have to watch total alc trends, you know, what's going on in spirits, what's going on in wine. Clearly, you know, a lot of the RTD PAB space has always been traditionally driven by what's been going on in the non-alc space. You know, go to those C stores, talk to the buyers there that are looking, you know, get out of the beer aisle, and you got to go into those other aisles and really identify emerging trends and say, all right, is that applicable to your space? And you just have to be able to keep moving forward, because this space is going to be competitive and competitive more and more with more entries. And if you stay pat, I think you'll find yourself in trouble.
We got another audience question. I mean, these are all audience questions at this point. If you've got one, we've got 10 minutes. This might be a little bit of a wishful thinking, but let's all hope that someday bars reopen in a meaningful way, maybe in 2021. So there are going to be far more seltzer drinkers out there than there were at the start of 2020. Will we see a draft seltzer become a thing? And to the craft brewery guests, that would be Christian and Archie, will you prioritize placement of your seltzer products at bars over your craft beer if your seltzer sales are still on fire come spring, summer 2021?
So we've already done that. We've experimented with draft seltzer, both in our own tap room and in local bars and restaurants. It's amazing the equity in the sleek can, the slim can. They want to hold that because you do all the profit picture and you're like, all right, 16-ounce glass, pour it on ice. The profitability picture for the retailer is amazing and how much they can make per keg, because, you know, it's only using 9 or 10 ounces of liquid when you add the ice. And, you know, we've tried, others have tried, and they want that slim, sleek can in their hand. It's like holding a clear bottle of an import. It really attaches the equity to that. And we've seen that in our conversion when we originally came out in the 12-ounce beer can till we switched to the sleek. It's become the badge of the category. It's one of those rarities that packaging really defines the category. And to Danelle's point about the spirit-based ones, to the wine-based ones, to the malt or and dextrose sucrose fermentation ones, if it's in the slim can, they just put it all in a group. It's one of those. And so we've tried Neon. Others have tried, but I still see it as a package category.
How do you feel about it, Amy? Is this a package-only category?
I would agree with Christian as well. I don't think it's package only, but I definitely think the flavor, you know, to be able to control that flavor and have that production at the canning level really does make sure that quality is there. I think you lose a little bit in draft. As you said, you pour it over ice. Myself, I don't like seltzer over ice because, again, pardon the pun, but it waters it down. And it does because it affects the carbonation and so forth. And, you know, so I think there's a lot of levels that play in that. The glass, depending on how clean it is, you know, I mean, there's a lot of different little nuances that if you really are after the taste, all that can be affected. So for me, the quality isn't the same. It's not a segment we're looking to look into heavily at all right now. Our demographic isn't there as much either. And so, you know, I think absolutely there's room for it. I don't think it's going to be everything though at all.
I can add a little bit to that from our on-premise team. I mean, they've been week by week, they've been talking to consumers and they have shared that hard seltzer drinkers are more likely to go back to bars and restaurants once they do open. And one other thing is, you know, consistently drinkers have been telling them that primary concerns, of course, around health and safety when they do go back to bars and restaurants. And cans actually can play a role in that because there can be this perception with draft and the glassware that it's not as there are more sanitation issues. And so cans just in very simple ways in terms of safety can play a bigger role, at least right now, until things really do get back to a new normal.
There is sort of a cool factor, I guess, of holding that slim can. I mean, how are you feeling about the on-prem, Archie?
I think it's a package play for a lot of reasons as well. You know, the equity, the branding that you get there, the message that the consumer's wanting to share with their friends, like Christian said, to have it in their hands. We actually played a little with draft at the beginning. And, you know, one thing that we found was it's such a clean product that, you know, there aren't a lot of proteins in that product for the bubbles to grab onto. And so you'll find that carbonation's fleeting. Just it's a tough thing to do. Then, you know, as a small point, like if Sam Adams couldn't make it work, there you go.
Yeah. What's funny, I guess, amazing, only being in the category for 5 years, we're kind of one of the old dogs in the room here. When we first started, on-premise was not interested at all. Like, we'd rather sell vodka sodas, flavored vodka sodas. The margin's much better. And I would say the first 2 years, other than the beach bars, kind of non-draft or non, you know, plastic cup kind of bars, there was almost no on-premise business available. But then the category just kind of overpowered. Consumers dictated that you need to carry seltzers. And then we started hearing from some of these, especially the younger 21 to 29 establishments, that, you know, some seltzer brands were their leading package for the distributors, their leading selling package in some of these bars, especially in more of the urban markets. But it was to the power of the category overcame the retailers who were really resistant to it at first and didn't want it in there.
I may or may not have had a Truly late last night at a bar.
I do know that Truly went from having Truly Pure on draft, which had no flavor, to like basically like the first week of March, they launched Wildberry Draft. But we all know what happened in the second week of March. So not really sure how that ended up turning out. But question for our panelists. What are brands channeling from the audience? What are brands channeling their marketing dollars to drive growth? What metrics are you looking at? So basically right now, where are you focusing your marketing spend while we're in this kind of like upside down crazy situation? Amy, where is press targeting for marketing spend at the moment?
You know, we spend quite a bit on concentration on social media and so forth, without a doubt. We like to connect one-on-one with our consumers. And as you know, that's timely and not as efficient, but it's definitely effective. And so for us, we really like that route. Again, just trying to continue the e-commerce panel, our channel. I think that it's going to change. The landscape's changing quite a bit and it's going to continue. And so we're putting a lot of our resources into that as well. But yeah, you know, primarily a lot of the sponsor, the whole scene of the virtual parties and, you know, getting creative with how we reach our consumers.
That makes a ton of sense. Christian, what were you guys doing in the beginning, in the early days of Naughty? How were you really getting the word out about the brand?
Yeah, so it's been a huge switch. So early on, all sampling, hand to cam combat in stores and looking for mass sampling events, festivals, you know, kind of riding sometimes in with your distributor that might have the beer sponsorship tied up, but all of a sudden you're, you know, everyone's creating the seltzer sponsorship now and cutting it out. And so we were able to take advantage of a lot of that early in the day, especially when there were, you know, some of the major brewers didn't have an entry in the category. So you could be that kind of slide under the radar of their sponsorships. So now almost exclusively social spend. So geofencing, geotargeting, consumers in different markets based on, you know, what brands we have and what territories, of just trying to push the at-home occasion, the refreshment, you know, trying to give them, without being in the store with them now, trying to give them all the information to, you know, disrupt that buying pattern I talked about. Like, don't buy the major national brands. Here's a local alternative that offers something different. And it's been a huge swing from that massive sampling, massive, you know, festival push to just trying to have those one-on-one conversations.
We've got a 2-minute warning here, I guess. So we're going to go a little bit lightning round here. If we can, just very quickly, audience question, what is your best selling flavor? So I'll shoot that to Christian.
Variety pack. Now it's, you know, we always say when we sample, it's like a boy band. Some people like Justin, some people like Joey, you know, you got to put them all out there and let them decide. And we see swings from week to week. What's the weather? When it's hotter, they like watermelon. When it's colder, they like some of the darker flavors. But it's a boy band. Someone likes all of them.
Amy, can you top that answer?
Sure. Well, our number one, per flavor, not package, is blackberry hibiscus, followed by pomegranate ginger. And then we have a new flavor. Here's my product plug for the pineapple lovers out there, which is a pineapple basil. And that's gotten some really great reviews as well. So our rotationals have done really well, and apple cinnamon. And so what we're looking to do is actually create a second variety pack with our rotationals. And so we can get them out there all year round.
Our advertising team will be in touch about that free plug there.
They were drinking it online. I'm just done. I'm just teasing.
My mom would be very excited to receive a sample pack.
Archie, what's the top seller at Butt-Ubs so far?
Variety for sure. But we're, you know, in that tap room, we're able to kind of have a little straw poll of everybody there. And the pink cherry lemonade is kind of running away with it at that point. As we go south, you know, it's peach season down here, and juicy peach is one that's kind of rearing up right now.
And that was last week's Frontlines. Friendly reminder to tune in next week when we check in with the Ballast Point team. If you have any suggestions for what you would like to see and hear from us at Brewbound, or if you want to share your favorite boy band member, you can drop us an email at podcast@brewbound.com. As always, a big thank you to all of our guests, the Brewbound Audiovisual Production Posse, my homie Justin, and of course to all of you for listening. We will see you next week.